So I did place a new homework. That's due Friday, even though we don't have class tomorrow. This is a relatively short homework problem, and it's relatively independent of what I'm saying in class these days. It's mostly math, okay? It's mostly self-contained. It's a sort of a good short homework for you to try out your overall understanding and math over a weekend, over a short week, not weekend. Over the holiday, perhaps, if you want to do the homework tomorrow, start it. I think you will be able to handle most of it. And in the meantime, I want to go back and finish this particular example that I had. This thing. So let me redraw that circuit here on the blackboard and discuss it a little bit more before we move on. Basically, we have a resistor, another resistor. I think this is 3 ohms, this is 1 ohms, and then there is a solenoid going through this loop with magnetic fields that are sticking out. And magnetic fields that are changing because the current is changing, there is an overall flux minus the CdT. When I write the time derivative of the flux with a minus sign in front of it, we recognize that as an EMF. And in this problem, the EMF was given as 8 volts. In an 8 volt EMF, this loop is going to conduct some current. You divide that 8 ohms EMF by the overall resistance, which is 4 ohms, you get a 2 ampere current flowing. That's as shown here, right? This is what we had. And the direction of that current is consistent with the right hand rule for the flux calculations we are suggesting, etc., etc. Okay? So now, our last discussion point, the weird fact that there is a 6 volt drop from here to here and plus another 2 volt drop from there to there. So overall, 8 volt drop without seeming being balanced by a rise. But the rise is there too. The rise is the EMF. It's just that it is coming in a different way than you are used to symbolically from forces like EC, E1, and E2. You have to sort of like adjust to what's going on there. And then I say, is there really 2 volts from here to here? Can I measure it with a voltmeter? Yes, I can measure it with a voltmeter. But so let's look at that a little bit. Okay, so I bring my voltmeter. My voltmeter is an instrument. It has some sort of a dial. It will indicate plus 2 or minus 2 depending which lead I connect where. Okay, but I need also leads. So I have a lead that touches here, and I have a lead that touches there. Okay, and let's say that this is the plus polarity and this is the minus polarity leads. Okay, that is the way this thing has been designed. And I make a little circuit here that is a little loop. Okay, now how much flux is going through that loop? Jason, how much magnetic flux is going through that loop? Let's say it is none. Yes, a good answer. Okay. Or let's say that maybe there's a little bit of a flux because that wire is conducting current, is generating that flux. But that's a DC current. Even though there might be a flux, there is surely no DDT of the flux. If there is no DDT of the flux through the loop that is formed by our 1 ohm resistor continued with the leads of the voltmeter connection, then the psi DT is equal to 0, and the EMF of that poop is equal to zero. Why don't I write that down? Okay, and that leads to sort of a right interpretation of what is it, how? What mathematically is the expression that matches to what voltmeter measures and reports? Okay, so I want to do that. So basically I write E dot dl around that closed loop C, and that closed loop C is this triangular loop that we are following, is equal to zero. It is equal to zero because even if there is a flux through this loop, linking that loop, that's the right terminology, it's not changing in time, therefore it is equal to zero. Alright? So that's basically a zero EMF associated with this. Whereas with this loop, there is an EMF. It's 8 volts. Okay? Now we are looking at two different loops, therefore there are two different statements that you can make. And I can now write this integral in two parts. First, I think over there, this is marked as A and this is marked as B. So let me now write that integral as from B to A and then A to B, the return. So I'm going to write this now. B to A of E dot dl followed by A to B, the return part over the second through the leads of the voltmeter. Okay, and that sum is also equal to zero. But I know that the first term here is not equal to zero. What is this?
Jason?
Now try to interpret that. That is the line integral of, it's the path integral as I go from B to A through this resistor. What does that correspond to? That is, by definition, voltage drop. It is by definition the voltage drop across that 2-ohm resistor, no, 1-ohm resistor, conducting 2 ampere current, and therefore that voltage is 2 volts. So I know that this guy is 2 volts. This is 2 volts. Now let me solve for this by taking this guy to the other side. Then it will come with a minus sign in front of it, but I can get rid of that minus sign by reversing the order of the integration limits. So this equation now then implies the following. So I take this to the other side and swap around. So it is now B to A rather than A to B, E dot dl is equal to 2 volts. Now, this is representing the line integral from here to here but through the voltmeter. And that is evidently 2 volts. That's what our voltmeter is reading. Any questions about this? Now, how does voltmeter work? It itself is a path that has very large resistance so that it draws almost no current. If it did draw current, I would be perturbing the system that I'm trying to measure, okay? Ideally, this is a path that has a resistance of infinity, open, so no current goes. But if no current goes, it can't measure anything, so you have to sort of cheat the system. You have a path that has a tremendously large resistance compared to the other resistance in the circuit, such as a mega ohm or something like that. So it steals away from the circuit incredibly small amount of current and passes it through itself. And along the path, there is a galvanometer. This galvanometer has a sort of a dial that will show if there is a current that flows. And that dial has been calibrated to measure voltage, basically, compared to known voltages. So that's what the voltmeter measures. So now, let me do the following modification. I am going to keep this connection intact, but I will break this and I will move around my voltmeter so that I have a new path. By the way, previously, in my previous connection, if I change the wires a little bit, move the wires a little bit, the reading wouldn't have changed because that particular path was path independent because in that region there was no magnetic field. There was the total flux contained length was zero. So therefore, as long as I didn't move the leads to the other side of the solenoid, I was okay. I was having stable, reasonable reading of 2 volts. Now that I have changed my connection scheme, this is still the plus side, this is the minus side, the picture has changed. This equation is no longer the same. How has this equation changed? This equation is no longer true. Why not, Mike?
Because now you have flux.
Now you have flux. So what do you do? You put 8 here. Now you're okay. It's not just the flux. It's the negative time derivative of the flux, which is the EMF. Now, in this path, I have this whole thing, okay? So now, how do I? What do I get for this? I no longer am going to get what 2 for this. What am I going to get? I can take this 2 to the other side and get 6. I'm going to measure 6. So what am I measuring? No longer the voltage of the resistor that we first measured. We are measuring the voltage of the other resistor. Okay, so this is what I said last time, and maybe this is a little bit more detailed exposition of how that comes about. Okay? So it does matter ultimately where the leads of the voltmeter is, okay? But it only matters if you move them through a region where there is a flux. Once again, once we have the leads of our voltmeter here, we can wiggle it around. As long as we don't cross the solenoid, we're going to be measuring 6 volts, which is the voltage of the resistor across which you have bona fide connected this particular thing. Any questions here? Okay. Actually, we're going to measure, what are we going to measure?
-6.
We're going to measure -6 volts, right? And how do I say that? How do I see that? A to B is the wrong way, right? Anyway, you guys work it out, so it works out. I'm confused right now, but it looks like this is still correct, right? This is, if we are going around the circuit this way, that is 8 volts, that is correct. This is still A to B. A to B is not 2 volts anymore, right? No, this is our loop, so this is still 2 volts, that is correct. And then we have A to B integral, and that is the voltage drop from here to here. And no, that is a voltage. I'm confused. You guys work it out, okay? Can somebody fix this to me? I'm confused. These things are confusing. But then I know the right answer.
It's a rise of the EMF's going.
Okay, so listen to this guy. He knows it better than I do. All right. Thank you. So are there any questions about this other than this sign confusion? I am also full of, I'm doing a show here. I get nervous once in a while. It's not the same as you sitting there. When I used to be a student, I used to catch all these mistakes of my teachers. It was very easy to do that, but it's a little bit different over there. So I'm confused. I apologize. We'll fix it. Anyways, but there is one more thing I want to say. Somebody here, I think his name was Lee, who was sitting here. Is he here today? Okay, so Lee asked me, what about calculating EMF, not through the minus deep CDT, but directly from the electric field integral, okay? And I say, you can't do that in a way, okay? It's very difficult. I want to comment a little bit on that. We are moving away from the comfortable world of static fields where we are simply using either directly the Coulomb's law or its extensions to calculate the fields once we know the charges. We are now in a world where the fields are also being generated because of time-varying currents. And what are our tools? Well, I say that we have 2 possible answers to this question. One is still Coulomb's law plus relativity. And that's very complicated, okay? We don't want to do that. If you do that once and generalize the result, your tools are Maxwell's equations. The complete set of Maxwell's equations. At this stage, we have added one more equation to our set, building towards that complete set, and that equation is Faraday's law, okay? So we have to find that electric field through Faraday's law. Basically, we are finding that electric field, Lee. We know that there is an EMF of total EMF of 8. Volts across here. We know that 6 of those volts appear across this resistor, and 2 of those volts appear across this particular second resistor. And if I ask you, what is the electric field inside this region that is a 3-ohm resistor, you're going to say, well, it's 6 volts divided whatever the length of that thing is. So you have found the electric field. How did you find the electric field? You have found the electric field using Faraday's law, okay? So you can only use either side of Faraday's law to calculate the EMF if you know the inputs of those sides. You know either B or E. If you don't know the inputs, you cannot use those equations to calculate the EMF. But if you can use one side to get the EMF, the other side gives you a way of solving what you don't know. And that's what I have demonstrated for this purpose, okay? Or you erase this entire set of resistor out of it, and you think of a symmetric circle encircling this solenoid. And that circle has a radius. And you know that the line integral over that circle, which is the electric field, parallel electric field times the path, is equal to 8 volts. And you know the length, you divide it by the length, 2 pi r, you still have the electric field that you're getting. So we are in that world, okay? So we are building towards finding our answers by solving Maxwell's equations. And it's going to be the full set of equations, including Faraday's laws and including Ampere's law. So that's what I wanted to comment on. Any questions here? Okay, so we're going to move on. Except for the sign, we know that the new voltage is going to be plus or minus 6 volts. And we move on to the next topic. Now, next topic is inductance. And to finish the homework problem that's due today at 5, maybe you need a little bit help of the next things that I'll be discussing. Okay, let's start with a coil. We have a coil. This is a wire. And for this coil, if there is a current that is flowing in this coil, Faraday's law applies. Let's write the Faraday's law in this fashion. Epsilon is minus d psi dt. Okay? So a current is flowing, I, and that is generating a magnetic flux. It generates a magnetic field. That magnetic field links this area, and that is exactly what is expressed here. Okay? So, this could be a static situation, or this could be a non-static situation, that I perhaps is changing as a function of time. If that I is changing as a function of time, then the magnetic field it's producing is changing as a function of time, the flux is changing as a function of time. It is that relationship that we are interested in pursuing. Okay? So I know that the C that I generate, if there is an I that is going to be proportional to the I itself. So then I say, in very general way, I'm going to say that C is L times I. L is some constant. This is the constant that I'm going to refer as the inductance. Okay? Now, what is epsilon? Well, if this wire has also some resistivity, epsilon is RI. Okay? So what do we have here? We have a sort of a familiar equation I'm just about to sort of like obtain here. If L is a constant, it can be pulled out. Then I have L di dt with a minus sign in front of it. I will take L di dt, put it on the other side, get rid of the minus sign. I obtain this equation, Ri plus L di dt equals 0. Okay? I have a differential equation now. Okay? If I were equal non-zero at some point, this differential equation tells me what is I going to be at the end. Jason? This has an exponential solution, doesn't it? It's a decaying exponential. So if I do start at t equals 0 with 1 ampere for whatever reason, that 1 ampere is going to be generating a magnetic flux, but that magnetic flux and I, they're all going to be dying out because of the resistance. The resistance is going to take the initially stored energy in the system, dissipating it. And this is the equation that describes the self-consistent evolution of the current and the accompanying magnetic fields. Okay? So that's an idea. Now suppose now I take a loop like this, but many of them. I have n of them. So I now ask myself the question, what is the total EMF that is associated with this coil that I have, n turn coil? Well, that is an extension of what I have started with, okay? Each of these turns, one complete turn, can be associated with a flux. Okay, with a epsilon that follows this, but I have n of them in series. So what is the total epsilon? It is the summation of all of those terms. If I have n of them, now I'm going to change my equation by multiplying this guy with n. That becomes my new expression. Okay. Now, I want to rewrite this equation just like we did before as L di dt. With a minus sign in front of it, okay? That's what we did before. I want to do this again, so that I will have the same differential equation describing the inductor whose terminals have been shorted, but there is still a resistance in that circuit because that inductor has been made from a wire that has resistance in it. Even though you don't explicitly see that resistor, that resistance is there. So that was, of course, inherent in this equation that we wrote. We wrote that equation for this guy. Okay, there was an inductance associated with that coil as well as resistance. You didn't see these things as lumped elements as in 210, but those lumped elements are nothing but lumped element models for these more general things. And once in a while, the circuit that you put together does look like a lumped element circuit. It has it's one element, two terminal element that looks like a resistor in series with another thing that is hidden, but inside there is a coil, etc. So circuits may look like they're model diagrams, or circuits may not look like their model diagrams, but we have to sort of like start understanding that fact as well. So then we have this coil, and I connect it. It still is going to be governed by this type of an equation, because there is an inherent resistance there, and there is an inherent inductance there, and if we start that whole circuit with some initial current, its current is going to decay away. Okay? Any questions? And then if we wish, we don't have to connect the two terminals of these things to one another with a short. We can put other elements. We can put a lump resistor there. We can put a voltage source in series with a lump. And if we have a voltage source in series with a resistor, it may be viewed as the Thevenin equivalent of something even more complicated. There we go. We have now connected our inductor, which is nothing but many, many coils together, into some element that is familiar, whose math we have learned earlier on in our earlier courses. Is this making sense? And here is the governing equation. And what is the corresponding L? Our L has evolved. Formerly, with this relationship, our L was defined to be whatever psi links the system divided by the current that is generating that psi. That was our equation. But now when we go to this one, okay, we have to say L is not simply psi divided by I, but N times psi divided by I for an N-turn inductor, okay? And that's a more general equation that can be applied if there is a single turn, so keep that as the definition of an inductor, if you will. Any questions there? Now, is L going to be then linearly dependent on the number of turns, or is it more complicated? Some guess. You scared that. You sit there watching. I think it's going to be not just proportional to n. It's going to be proportional to n squared, right? Can you see that? Because psi is not going to be the same psi of a single term. Originally, when we have a single term, this psi is coming about because of the magnetic field generated by a single term. If you have a second term carrying the same amount of current, that is also generating the magnetic field, and that's going to add up. Because of that, although it appears here, my equation for L is directly proportional to n, this C is the linked flux of any one of the single loops, but any one of the flux of the single loops depend on the existence of n sources. Therefore, there is going to be an n squared sort of a dependence. Any questions here? But that's a little bit of a complication here. So all this stuff is, of course, covered in the next lecture. So let me show the relevant pages here. Okay, and let's move on to calculate the inductance of a multi-turn coil by taking advantage of the internal magnetic field that we have worked out for a solenoid. Okay, we worked out the field for an infinite solenoid, but a spiral with many turns is going to be well approximated with that. The internal field of a coil with many turns can be sort of approximated as the field of an internal field of an infinite solenoid. The only difference is that when you get out of the finite length coil, you're going to get into the zero fields land, where the field is not going to be exactly zero, but it's going to be weak. It's going to be the fringe fields, okay? But as far as calculating the flux that you care for, you can use the solenoid magnetic field. Okay, so there is an example which I'm skipping, but that example is very much similar to what we have done here, this equation, okay? And so I bring you to this solenoid calculation. So let's use this formula to calculate the inductance of a solenoid, for instance. So we have a solenoid with n turns. And we have a total length of L. Okay? And therefore, we have n divided by L
That is the number of turns per meter.
This is a quantity that we called by capital N when we derived the formula for the solenoid that was used. Okay? In terms of that quantity, the magnetic field B that is generated in an infinite solenoid is this thing, mu naught, the current that is circulating around, and this number density, number of turns per unit length, capital N. If this, and this is pointing in Z direction, okay? So if we want to have the Z-directed flux, what do? We dot multiply with this Z, turn it into a scalar, and then multiply it with the overall area of that particular solenoid. So then flux that we are concerned with is mu naught I times N, and this N is little n divided by L, times cross-sectional area. Okay, that I don't know what that cross-sectional area is, but you can measure it, and it's going to be showing up in the formula for the inductance. It does matter. In the case of inductance, the geometry matters, the dimensions matter. It turns out the number of turns matters, and the medium matters. Mu naught we are using, but if the same coil was wound around not free space but some other material with a mu other than mu naught, which is a topic that we'll get in next lecture, then you would use that mu. Okay? So here we go. So now I substitute this flux guy here into this equation. Okay? When I do that, the current from here gets canceled by the current over there, and we get something for our inductance. Let's follow that. L now becomes mu naught times N over little L, and then from the other side another N is coming, and we are getting an area. Okay, so that looks like our inductance. Is that correct? How does it compare with the equation that we have on the other side? We can write it in a sort of in a slightly different way. We can put another little L here so that we can put L here. And that now you see that it is n squared dependent, as I advertised. But now we can erase these n over l and put it capital N squared. That's another way of writing that. Yeah.
And that l is equal to c over I. Why did you multiply that by m?
That is because I erased that stuff. Why didn't you ask that question before? Okay. So what I did was I had the equation for a single coil. Okay. And minus the psi dt for a single coil gives me the epsilon, which is the E naught. All right. Now I consider not a single coil, but I have a turn, but instead of stopping it, I go to another turn, another turn, another turn, okay? Now I create a new element. This is my multi-turn coil, okay? Now, what is the EMF of this guy? It is the line integral through the entire spiral, okay? And when I do that, what am I going to get? I'm going to get the series combination of the EMFs of all of those things, they're adding up. So, therefore, my EMF is the previous EMF multiplied by N. Okay, and then I say, I want to write that as, I want to keep the psi to be the psi of a single turn, but I will still want to write this guy to be as minus LBI dt. So that forces me to change my definition for L. My definition for L is no longer just this guy, okay, but it's this guy. When I said that 5 minutes ago, this is when I expected some question like yours, all right?
No, because you already changed psi to psi due to N turns.
Pardon?
You already?
No,
that.
It's both. Both effects are coming about. I am adding all the EMFs. Okay, there is a series combination of each EMF, and in the calculation of each EMF, I have to consider the total flux that is linked to each loop. Okay, each loop is producing a magnetic field, and those magnetic fields are all adding up. If you are confused about them, separate these loops away from one another to clearly recognize that each loop is a magnetic field source, and then you have to superpose all of them. Of course, if you separate these loops very far away, the magnetic fields at any location is going to be dominated by the nearest loops and not the furthest away ones, but that is not the situation. They're all together, and because of that, they're all adding up. Okay? So, there are two things going on. I have N here because my EMF get multiplied n times because I added n EMFs on top of one another. That C is still the linked flux of each term, but that also grew by n-fold, okay? Because of the close proximity. Overall, you got an n square, all right? So, now, I had a bunch of N over L's, which I turn into capital N. N is in turns per meter units. And I have this equation. Let's investigate this equation. I think this equation is correct. Dimensionally, it is correct. This is, what is this? This is Henry's per meter. Okay? And this guy is area times length. Therefore, it is volume. That's meter cube. Okay? But this is 1 over meter square. So all the meter cubes cancel one another. What do we have this group in terms of the units?
Henry's.
So that's the right sort of thing. Any questions? So now we have calculated the sort of like the most standard classical inductance formula, because the picture of an inductor in your mind is precisely this sort of a thing. Okay? Even though, if we have time, we'll go ahead and calculate the inductance and inductance per unit length of a coax that is shorted. That is not a classical one, but the same ideas apply. But this is an important formula, and keep remembering this, that there is as the inductance increases, as the number of turns squared. Any questions? All right, so let's move on. Now, I have this inductor. Do I want to comment? Are there any questions regarding the last homework problem? The very last part of the very last homework problem is that has some thinking associated with it. Let me comment on that before I move on. In that problem, we have two loops, okay? A large loop that is carrying, that has a 5-volt voltage source, and I don't remember the resistance, but it is generating a current because of that, and that current creates a magnetic field. That magnetic field links through a small loop that is of concern. Okay? In earlier parts last week, you calculated something that we called mutual coupling inductance. Okay? Today we have been talking about self-inductances. Alright? So this is something a little bit different. This is the only time in the course you'll be seeing mutual inductance, but it's a sort of a loaded and deep problem in some sense. Okay. You calculate the inductance in some part for this located at the origin, okay? But later on, we talk about this thing moving upwards with a certain velocity, then that inductance becomes a function of?
Z.
But Z is a function of? Time. Because you're moving with some, well, I forgot, 2 meters per second or something like that.
1 meter.
Or I don't remember, it's not important. The Z is then the velocity times time, okay? Yes, the flux that is linked depends on Z at the instantaneous Z. That Z is changing as a function of time, and because of that, that inductance, coupled inductance is changing as a function of time. And if you have a coupled inductance that is changing as a function of time, well, maybe you didn't look at the problem that way, but you did certainly get the inductance from the coupled linked flux, which is changing as a function of time, and you divide it by the current of the source. That was your coupled inductance. So maybe I'm pointing out an aspect of this problem that we didn't look at. But ultimately, what we are asked in the very last part of that problem is, while this moving small circle is on its way up, what is the differential equation that governs the current that is flowing in this particular loop? That is the last equation. Okay, how do we attack this? So I'm going to give you the answer, more or less, because you have had the opportunity to look at this. You either solved this problem by now, or you're still confused about it. Let me almost give the problem to you. So let's focus on this particular loop, and let us write Faraday's law for this loop. Okay, there is going to be an EMF associated with the action going there, and there is going to be, of course, always EMF is equal to, what is it, minus ddt of psi. Now, that psi should be the total linked flux coming from all the sources, okay? It is partially coming from this guy, but it is also coming from itself. Because if there is any current that is flowing in the small wire, and there is, because an EMF is produced, by the time rate of change of the flux coming, because of the flux that is coming from the other, there is going to be a current. But that current generates magnetic field, and that magnetic field has a flux. That has to be taken into account. So I claim that you get the right answer for that equation as follows. You say the EMF in the second loop is equal to negative ddt of the total flux. The total flux consists of self-flux plus the coupled flux. Okay? So let me write this now. Self-flux plus the coupled flux. Okay? Now, this epsilon is R times I. This loop also has a resistance. Okay? So now, let me take the self-flux and put it on the other side. Now, what is the self-flux? Self-flux is self-inductance times, say something, current. Which current? The current in the small one, not the big one. Right? It is this. So this guy is nothing other than L self, okay, which is given in the problem. I think it's 25 micro, or I don't remember exactly what number was. That is given times I sub S. And this I is also the self current. That is the S for small. It doesn't matter. Okay. So we are getting somewhere. Okay. But this self inductance is a constant. Okay. It doesn't depend on time. I can pull it out and I can write the entire self term on the other side of the equation. Where am I going? Here I'm going. Resistance of the small loop times the current of that small loop plus this is plus self-inductance, which is given in the problems, ddt of I sub s equals what's left it is minus ddt of the coupled flux. This is the quantity that you calculated in a previous section of the problem. Okay, that was exactly what you calculated. It is non-zero. It is a driver. You have a differential equation right now that if you look at, because this side is not equal to zero, it is an inhomogeneous differential equation. All right? If the right side is equal to zero, it would be a homogeneous equation, and that would be solved through an exponential means. But in the case of a differential equation that has a forcing side, then you have to solve the full problem. And how do you solve it? You find a homogeneous solution and you add on top of that a particular solution, techniques like that. We are not asking you to solve the problem, but we ask you to obtain this differential equation. Now I gave it to you. Because if it's sort of a confusing thing, there are new ideas there, you have to consider the entire flux. Brian, are you okay? Brian and Dylan? Okay. So that's how it works. The driving is coming. See, this is not proportional to I sub s. This is proportional to I that is in the big loop, okay? That is a DC one, okay? And the time variation of this is coming about not because this current is changing. It is not. That current is fixed. But this is still time varying because the cross-coupled inductance is changing as a function of time. So in general, this is a function of time. Therefore, this is non-zero. This is the problem. So yes, Alex, you have a question.
Now, what if we... Now, we assume that that larger loop, ideally, it's like there's no effect of that small loop on the big loop. Now, if we were to consider the small loop's effect on the large one?
Small ones, see, this is also generating something, and that would also have, you can write an equation like this also for this, basically. Okay? But in the long run, in the steady state, okay, depending on whether you have DC steady state or AC steady state, the homogeneous part of the equation, that part of the solution dies away, okay? And ultimately, it is this term with this term that is giving the steady state solution. Okay? So there's going to be some transient effect because of this coupling, but that's basically about that. Any questions about it? So I want to move on, though. But this was just a help for you to finish your homework. What is the next topic? The next topic is related to stuff that I have erased from the blackboard. But they are over there, so we'll pick them up. Okay, so now we have our inductor. Okay, we know that we have this EMF that can be written as LdIdt minus LdIdt. So LdIdt is the voltage drop across the inductor in the direction of current, and the negative of that is just the voltage rise. The negative of voltage drop is always the voltage rise. So that is the relationship between EMF and voltage. Hopefully this is a little bit more clear than it might have been before. Or maybe I confuse you, but hopefully you can sort out those issues. So let's go to the language of ECE210 and just simply say V equals LdIdt. Now considering V as the voltage drop, and now you know how to calculate L from the geometry of the situation. And then, of course, when we see this thing as a I voltage like this as a two-terminal element, we are concerned about the absorbed power, and that is simply V times I, which is I times L dIdt, which of course can be written as dDt of 1/2 Li squared. Okay, that is absorbed power, which means that 1/2 Li squared is stored energy. Okay, so I am now reminding you something from ECE210. So stored energy is 1/2 Li squared. Now we can substitute into this animal the equation for L that I lost. It was somewhere else. Okay, but that whole calculation is being given at the bottom of this page, so let's just follow it from there. So 1/2 Li squared, after I substitute the formula for L, okay, then I say, that is an interesting equation, but it is also related to the magnetic field equation, right? My magnetic field in z direction was n times mu naught times area times I, right? What was our, so my area was not involved. My B was simply mu naught I times L. So let's just take advantage of that. Okay, coming to this bottom equation. Mu naught n I, that's B. I have n squared, I squared, but mu naught not squared, okay? So let me square mu naught, but compensate for that by putting a mu naught in the bottom. Then I get this equation, because I do recognize n times mu naught times I as my B sub C, that is squared. So evidently this equation, and that's 2 becomes there, BZ squared divided by 2 mu naught times AL. What is AL? It is the volume of the cylinder, okay? So I have my energy to be some quantity times the volume, okay? So this quantity is therefore energy per volume. It's energy density. So 1/2 B squared over mu naught is energy density. That's sort of like awkward, okay? So if people put another mu naught here, put another mu naught there to compensate, then say B over mu naught is H. So the formula that I will remember is 1/2 mu naught H squared, that is energy density. That's joules per meter cube. I multiply it with the meter cube for the volume. I have my total energy of the inductor. So that is a sort of a way of referring to energy stored because of a magnetic field. This is generalized, and we associate with all space that has H in it a local energy density, and that is the energy density due to magnetic field. It accompanies 1/2 epsilon E squared as the add-on. 1/2 epsilon E squared is the electric field related stored energy. Magnetic field related stored energy is this guy, 1/2 mu H squared, and their sum is the total one, which shows up in Poynting's theorem, which is coming sometime next week. Any questions? Let's move on. So, and at that mu naught, change with mu, if you are in a material. If a material is residing where the most intense magnetic fields that define an inductive system is not air, but some other material, use the mu of that region. So, what about the inductance of a shorted coax? So, here's the picture. I take a length of coax and short it on one side. Now, because conduction of a current there, I can have a current going in the inner loop, go up and go inside the outer loop. And the two terminals I have can be connected to another circuit. So I can view this thing as an inductor. Okay. I also could have viewed this as a capacitor, but capacitors, I don't short capacitors. Two plates of the capacitors kept apart. So if I get rid of that short, we already analyzed this thing as an capacitor. Now we're going to use it as an inductor. In the long run, sometimes we'll short our coaxes, sometimes we'll open them, and there will be, in accordance to that, either capacitive or inductive behavior. We will also find out that when you look from the front, okay, it depends on this length. Okay, so because of that, really what matters is inductance per unit length and capacitance per unit length. This is what we want to calculate. All right, so let's do the math now. I'm going to get the inductance of this, then inductance per unit length. For inductance purposes, I have to calculate the flux and divide the flux by the current. Okay? And flux what? Flux linked. Linked to what? To the integration surface. Okay? There is an integration surface. Line integral integration circuit is also the circuit in which the current flows. In the shorted inductor, current flows in the loop that is depicted here. It's this loop. It's a rectangular looking loop. And through that, there is a magnetic field given by the right-hand rule. Okay? Find that magnetic field, calculate the flux, divide that flux by I, you have an inductance. Okay? This is a sort of an analog calculation for how we calculate the capacitance. In capacitance case, we got the electric field, we integrated the electric from inner conductor to outer conductor that gave us a voltage, and that gave us the capacitance effectively, because that electric field that we integrated to get voltage was proportional to the amount of charge that existed on that surface, and capacitance is voltage divided by the charge, or the other way around. Q equals CV. Okay, so C is Q divided by voltage. Now in this case, it's going to be flux divided by current. Right? Are you with me? So now we go ahead with the calculation. First, we need the magnetic field that we need to calculate the flux of that. That magnetic field is encircling the inner conductor in accordance with the right-hand rule. To get that, I do an Amperian circle. Line integrated. So I'm going to go around, as indicated there, around the inner conductor at some radius r away from the center of this whole geometry. R is between A and B, the radii of the inner and outer conductor. And then I'm going to utilize this equation. Okay, this equation is easy to handle. There is a phi directed, phi is the direction of my right-hand rule, magnetic field that I'm looking for. That times 2 pi r, which is the total length over which this integration is performed, that is equal to the entire and enclosed current. That enclosed current is the current that's going in the inner conductor with the mu naught. Okay? So this is our Ampere's law application to get B of phi. B of phi is mu naught times I divided by 2 pi r. Actually, this is the familiar equation that we have for a current carrying infinite line. Now that we have this, we are poised to calculate the flux. And here's our flux calculation. Okay, it's going to be a surface area integral, and that surface area integral is the entire rectangular thing. It has a distance L on the bottom, and it extends from r equals a to r equals to b. The in the horizontal direction, my integration along one direction comes as a free b, because this magnetic field is only changing as a function of r. So I multiply it by L, but the remaining flux calculation comes at an integral, and that integral is dr over r from a to b. And here we go, we have an equation that gives us an ln, and ln is evaluated at b and minus a. That gives you ln b over a. That's our flux, and it's proportional to I. We take this I underneath, call the remainder inductance. That is proportional to L. We don't like that either. We take it to the other side, then we call what we get as inductance per unit length. Okay? And here are all these results. So L here is the formula that we get, and then we turn this L into funny L by dividing this equation by the length of the segment that we calculated. LNB over A, 2 pi times mu naught. Now, if we go back to the equation for the capacitance per unit length for the same coax, length L but not shorter, that formula was what you see on the bottom. Okay? There is a geometrical factor that came up here, which is unitless, which is the opposite, inverse of the geometrical factor here. Okay, so basically, there is an algorithm here. If you know the capacitance per unit length, the inductance per unit length can come about as follows. You replace epsilon with mu naught, you take the geometrical factor and invert it upside down. Okay, so for any configuration that can be used in this way, either as an inductor or a capacitor, with an open and a short situation, this applies, okay? So we only need to calculate either the inductance or capacitance per unit length, the other one comes free. Now, also remember, if we replace epsilon naught with sigma, we get the conductance per unit length, okay? And not inverting the geometric factor of capacitance, okay? But if you want the resistance per unit length, then you would replace that with not sigma, but inverse of sigma rho, and then you would invert the geometrical factor, which is, of course, taking the G and inverting it upside down. Okay, so I'll see you guys after celebrating this holiday. It's been very hot these days, incredible, huh? Very hot days.